The Dothraki would esteem her all the more for a few bells in her hair. She chimed as she mounted her silver mare, and again with every stride. But neither Ser Jorah nor her blood riders made mention of it. To guard her people and her dragons in her absence, she chose Rakaru. Jogo and Aego would ride with her to the waterfront. They left the marble palaces and fragrant gardens behind and made their way through a poorer part of the city where modest brick houses turned blind walls to the street. There were fewer horses and camels to be seen and a dearth of palanquins, but the streets teemed with children, beggars, and skinny dogs the colour of sand. Pale men in dusty linen skirts stood beneath arched doorways to watch them pass. They know who I am, and they do not love me. Danny could tell from the way they looked at her. Ser Jorah would sooner have tucked her inside her palanquin, safely hidden behind silken curtains, but she refused him. She had reclined too long on the satin cushions, letting oxen bear her hither and yon. At least when she rode, she felt as though she were getting somewhere. It was not by choice that she sought the waterfront. She was fleeing again. Her whole life had been one long flight, it seemed. She had begun running in her mother's womb and never once stopped. How often had she and Viserys stolen away in the black of night, a bare step ahead of the usurper's hired knives? But it was run or die. Zaro had learned that Pyat Pree was gathering the surviving warlocks together to work ill on her. Danny had laughed when he told her. "Was it not you who told me warlocks were no more than old soldiers, vainly boasting of forgotten deeds and lost prowess?" Zaro looked troubled.
"And so it was then, but now I am less certain. It is said that the glass candles are burning in the house of Urath the Nightwalker, that have not burned in 100 years. Ghost grass grows in the garden of Gethain. Phantom tortoises have been seen carrying messages between the windowless houses on Warlock's Way, and all the rats in the city are chewing off their tails. The wife of Mathis Malarawan, who once mocked a warlock's drab, moth-eaten robe, has gone mad and will wear no clothes at all. Even fresh-washed silks make her feel as though 1,000 insects were crawling on her skin. And blind Sybassian, the eater of eyes, can see again, or so his slaves do swear. A man must wonder," he sighed. "These are strange times in Karth, and strange times are bad for trade. It grieves me to say so, yet it might be best if you left Karth entirely, eh? And sooner rather than later."
Zara stroked her fingers reassuringly.
"You need not go alone, though. You have seen dark visions in the Palace of Dust, but Zaro has dreamed brighter dreams. I see you happily abed, with our child at your breast. Sail with me around the Jade Sea, and we can yet make it so. It is not too late. Give me a son, my sweet song of joy."
"Give you a dragon, you mean? I will not wed you, Zaro." His face had grown cold at that.
"Then go."
"But where?"
"Somewhere, far from here."
Well, perhaps it was time. The people of Akalasar had welcomed the chance to recover from the ravages of the Red Waste, but now that they were plump and rested once again, they began to grow unruly. Dothraki were not accustomed to staying long in one place. They were a warrior people, not made for cities. Perhaps she had lingered in Karth too long, seduced by its comforts and its beauties. It was a city that always promised more than it would give you, it seemed to her, and her welcome, here, had turned sour since the House of the Undying had collapsed in a great gout of smoke and flame. Overnight the Karthian had come to remember that dragons were dangerous. No longer did they vie with each other to give her gifts. Instead, the Tourmaline Brotherhood had called openly for her expulsion, and the ancient Guild of Spices for her death. It was all Zaro could do to keep the 13 from joining them. But where am I to go? Sir Jorah proposed that they journey farther east, away from her enemies in the Seven Kingdoms. Her blood riders would sooner have returned to their great grass sea, even if it meant braving the Red Waste again. Dany herself had toyed with the idea of settling in Vaes Tolaro until her dragons grew great and strong, but her heart was full of doubts. Each of these felt wrong somehow, and even when she decided where to go, the question of how she would get there remained troublesome. Zarozoan Daxus would be no help to her. She knew that now. For all his professions of devotion, he was playing his own game, not unlike Pyat Pree. The night he asked her to leave, Dany had begged one last favor of him.
"An army, is it?"
Zaro asked.
"A kettle of gold? A galley, perhaps?"
Dany blushed. She hated begging. "A ship, yes." Zaro's eyes had glittered as brightly as the jewels in his nose.
"I'm a trader, Khaleesi, so perhaps we should speak no more of giving, but rather of trade. For one of your dragons, you shall have 10 of the finest ships in my fleet. You need only say that one sweet word."
"No," she said.
"Alas," Zaro sobbed, "that was not the word I meant."
"Would you ask a mother to sell one of her children?"
"Why ever not, eh? They can always make more. Mothers sell their children every day."
"Not the mother of dragons?"
"Not even for 20 ships."
"Not for 100. His mouth curled downward.
"I do not have 100, but you have 3 dragons, huh? Grant me one for all my kindnesses. You will still have 2, and 30 ships as well."
30 ships would be enough to land a small army on the shores of Westeros. But I do not have a small army. "How many ships do you own, Zaro?"
83, if one does not count my pleasure barge."
"And your colleagues in the 13?
"Among us all, perhaps 1,000.
"And the Spices and the Tourmaline Brotherhood?"
"Their trifling fleets are of no account."
"Even so," she said, "tell me."
1,200 or 1,300 for the Spices, no more than 800 for the Brotherhood."
"And the Ashai, the Bravasi, the Summer Islanders, the Ibanese, and all the other peoples who sail the Great Salt Sea, how many ships do they have all together?"
"Many and more," he said irritably. "What does this matter?"
"I am trying to set a price on one of the 3 living dragons in the world." Dany smiled at him sweetly. "It seems to me that 1/3 of all the ships in the world would be fair." Zara's tears ran down his cheeks on either side of his jewel-encrusted nose.
"Did I not warn you not to enter the Palace of Dust, eh? This is the very thing I feared. The whispers of the warlocks have made you as mad as Malarowan's wife. 1/3 of all the ships in the world? Ha! Ha! I say, ha!"
Dany had not seen him since. His seneschal brought her messages, each cooler than the last. She must quit his house. He was done feeding her and her people. He demanded the return of his gifts, which she had accepted in bad faith. Her only consolation was that at least she had had the great good sense not to marry him. The warlocks whispered of 3 treasons, once for blood, and once for gold, and one's for love. The first traitor was surely Miramazdur, who had murdered Khal Drogo and their unborn son to avenge her people. Could Pyat Pree and Zarozoan Daxus be the second and the third? She did not think so. What Pyat did was not for gold, and Zaro had never truly loved her. the streets grew emptier as they passed through a district given over to gloomy stone warehouses. Ego went before her, and Jogo behind, leaving Sir Jorah Mormont at her side. Her bell rang softly, and Dany found her thoughts returning to the Palace of Dust once more, as the tongue returns to a space left by a missing tooth. Child of three, they had called her. Daughter of death, slayer of lies, bride of fire. So many threes. Three fires, three mounts to ride, three treasons. The dragon has three heads, she sighed. Do you know what that means, Jorah? Your Grace, the sigil of House Targaryen is a three-headed dragon, red on black. I know that, but there are no three-headed dragons. The three heads were Aegon and his sisters. Visenya and Rhaenys, she recalled. I am descended from Aegon and Rhaenys through their son Aenys and their grandson Jaehaerys. Blue lips speak only lies. Isn't that what Zorro told you? Why do you care what the warlocks whispered? All they wanted was to suck the life from you. You know that now. Perhaps, she said reluctantly. Yet the things I saw, a dead man in the prow of a ship, a blue rose, a banquet of blood. What does any of it mean, Khaleesi? A mummer's dragon, you said. What is a mummer's dragon, pray?
A cloth dragon on poles, Danny explained. Mummers use them in their follies to give the heroes something to fight. Sir Jorah frowned. Danny could not let it go. His is the song of ice and fire, my brother said. I'm certain it was my brother, not Viserys, Rhaegar. He had a harp with silver strings. Sir Jorah's frown deepened until his eyebrows came together.
Prince Rhaegar played such a harp, he conceded. You saw him?
She nodded. There was a woman in a bed with a babe at her breast. My brother said the babe was the prince that was promised, and told her to name him Aegon.
Prince Aegon was Rhaegar's heir by a Liar of Dawn, Sir Jorah said. But if he was the prince that was promised, the promise was broken along with his skull when the Lannisters dashed his head against a wall.
I remember, Danny said sadly. They murdered Rhaegar's daughter as well, the little princess. Rhaenys, she was named, like Aegon's sister. There was no Visenya, but he said the dragon has three heads. What is the song of ice and fire?
It's no song I've ever heard.
I went to the warlocks hoping for answers, but instead they've left me with 100 new questions. By then there were people in the streets once more.
Make way!
Aegon shouted, while Jogo sniffed at the air suspiciously.
I smell it, Khaleesi, he called. The poison water.
The Dothraki distrusted the sea and all that moved upon it. Water that a horse could not drink was water they wanted no part of. They will learn, Danny resolved. I braved their sea with Khal Drogo. Now they can brave mine. Carth was one of the world's great ports, its great sheltered harbour, a riot of colour and clangour and strange smells. Wine sinks, warehouses, and gaming dens lined the streets, cheek by jowl with cheap brothels and the temples of peculiar gods. Cut purses, cut throats, spell sellers, and money changers mingled with every crowd. The waterfront was one great marketplace where the buying and selling went on all day and all night, and goods might be had for a fraction of what they cost at the bazaar, if a man did not ask where they came from. Wizened old women, bent like hunchbacks, sold flavoured waters and goat's milk from glazed ceramic jugs strapped to their shoulders. Seamen from 50 nations wandered amongst the stalls, drinking spiced liquors and trading jokes in queer-sounding tongues. The air smelled of salt and frying fish, of hot tar and honey, of incense and oil and sperm. Aegon gave an urchin a copper for a skewer of honey-roasted mice and nibbled them as he rode. Jogo bought a handful of fat white cherries. Elsewhere they saw beautiful bronze daggers for sale, dried squids, and carved onyx, a potent magical elixir made of virgin's milk and shade of the evening. Even dragon's eggs, which looked suspiciously like painted rocks. As they passed the long stone quays reserved for the ships of the 13, she saw chests of saffron, frankincense, and pepper being offloaded from Zaro's ornate vermilion kiss. Beside her, casks of wine, bales of sour leaf, and pallets of striped hides were being trundled up the gangplank onto the Bride in Azure, to sail on the evening tide. Farther along, a crowd had gathered around the Spicer Galley, Sunblaze, to bid on slaves. It was well known that the cheapest place to buy a slave was right off the ship, and the banners floating from her mast proclaimed that the Sunblaze had just arrived from Astapor on Slaver's Bay. Danny would get no help from the 13, the Tourmaline Brotherhood, or the Ancient Guild of Spices. She rowed her silver past several miles of their quays, docks, and storehouses, all the way out to the far end of the horseshoe-shaped harbour where the ships from the Summer Islands, Westeros, and the Nine Free Cities were permitted to dock. She dismounted beside a gaming pit, where a basilisk was tearing a big red dog to pieces amidst a shouting ring of sailors. Aegor, Jogar, you will guard the horses while Sir Jorah and I speak to the captains.
As you say, Khaleesi, we will watch you as you go.
It was good to hear men speaking Valyrian once more, and even the common tongue, Danny thought, as they approached the first ship. Sailors, dock workers, and merchants alike gave way before her, not knowing what to make of the slim young girl with silver-gold hair, who dressed in the Dothraki fashion and walked with a knight at her side. Despite the heat of the day, Sir Jorah wore his green wool surcoat over chain mail, the black bear of Mormont sewn on his chest. But neither her beauty nor his size and strength would serve with the men whose ships they needed.
"You require passage for 100 Dothraki, all their horses, yourself and this knight, and 3 dragons," said the captain of the great Cog, Ardent Friend, before he walked away laughing.
When she told Elysene on the Trumpeteer that she was Daenerys Stormborn, Queen of the 7 Kingdoms, he gave her a dead-faced look and said,
"Aye, and I'm Lord Tywin Lannister, and shit gold every night."
The cargo master of the Moorish galley, Silken Spirit, opined that dragons were too dangerous at sea, where any stray breath of flame might set the rigging afire. The owner of Lord Faro's belly would risk dragons, but not Dothraki.
"I'll have no such godless savages in my belly, I'll not."
The two brothers who captained the sister ships, Quicksilver and Greyhound, seemed sympathetic and invited them into the cabin for a glass of Arbor Red. They were so courteous that Danny was hopeful for a time, but in the end, the price they asked was far beyond her means and might have been beyond Zara's. Pinchbottom Petto and Slow-Eyed Maid were too small for her needs. Bravo was bound for the Jade Sea, and Magister Manolo scarce looked seaworthy. As they made their way toward the next quay, Sir Jorah laid a hand against the small of her back.
"Your Grace, you're being followed. No, do not turn."
He guided her gently towards a brass seller's booth.
"This is a noble work, my queen," he proclaimed loudly,
lifting a large platter for her inspection.
"See how it shines in the sun."
The brass was polished to a high sheen. Danny could see her face in it, and when Sir Jorah angled it to the right, she could see behind her.
"I see a fat brown man and an older man with a staff. Which is it?"
"Both of them," Sir Jorah said. "They have been following us since we left Quicksilver."
The ripples in the brass stretched the strangers queerly, making one man seem long and gaunt, the other immensely squat and broad.
"A most excellent brass, great lady," the merchant exclaimed. "Bright as the sun, and for the mother of dragons, only 30 honours."
The plateau is not worth more than 3. "Where are my guards?" Danny declared. "This man is trying to rob me." For Jorah, she lowered her voice and spoke in the common tongue.
"They may not mean me ill. Men have looked at women since time began. Perhaps it's no more than that."
The brass seller ignored their whispers.
30, did I say 30? Oh, such a fool I am. The price is 20 honors.
All the brass in this booth is not worth 20 honors, Danny told him as she studied the reflections. The old man had the look of Westeros about him, and the brown-skinned one must weigh 20 stone. The usurper offered a lordship to the man who kills me, and these two are far from home. Or could they be creatures of the warlocks, meant to take me unawares?
10, Khaleesi, because you are so lovely. Huh? Use it for a looking-glass. Only brass this fine could capture such beauty.
It might serve to carry night soil. If you threw it away, I might pick it up, so long as I did not need to stoop. But pay for it? Danny shoved the platter back into his hands. Worms have crawled up your nose and eaten your wits.
8 honors, he cried. My wife will beat me and call me a fool, but I am a helpless child in your hands. Come, 8. That is less than it is worth.
What do I need with dull brass when Zarozo and Daxus feeds me off plates of gold? As she turned to walk off, Danny let her glance sweep over the strangers. The brown man was near as wide as he looked in the platter, with a gleaming bald head and the smooth cheeks of a eunuch. A long, curving arrack was thrust through the sweat-stained yellow silk of his belly band. Above the silk, he was naked, but for an absurdly tiny iron-studded vest. Old scars crisscrossed his tree-trunk arms, huge chest, and massive belly, pale against his nut-brown skin. The other man wore a traveller's cloak of undyed wool, the hood thrown back. Long white hair fell to his shoulders, and a silky white beard covered the lower half of his face. He leaned his weight on a hardwood staff, as tall as he was. Only fools would stare so openly if they meant me harm. All the same, it might be prudent to head back toward Jogo and Ego. "The old man does not wear a sword," she said to Jorah in the common tongue, as she drew him away. The brass merchant came hopping after them.
5 honors for 5, it is yours. It was meant for you.
So Jorah said,
"A hardwood staff can crack a skull as well as any mace."
4, I know you want it.
He danced in front of them, scampering backward as they thrust the platter at their faces. "Do they follow?"
Lift that up a little higher,
the knight told the merchant.
"Yes. The old man pretends to linger at a potter's stall, but the brown one has eyes only for you."
2 honors! 2! 2!
The merchant was panting heavily from the effort of running backward. "Pay him before he kills himself," Danny told Sir Jorah, wondering what she was going to do with a huge brass platter. She turned back as he reached for his coins, intending to put an end to this mummer's farce. The blood of the dragon would not be herded through a bazaar by an old man and a fat eunuch. A Carthene stepped into her path.
"A mother of dragons for you."
He knelt and thrust a jewel box into her face. Danny took it almost by reflex. The box was carved wood, its mother-of-pearl lid inlaid with jasper and chalcedony.
"You are too generous."
She opened it. Within was a glittering green scarab carved from onyx and emerald. Beautiful, she thought. This will help pay our passage. As she reached inside the box, the man said,
"I'm so sorry,"
but she hardly heard. The scarab unfolded with a hiss. Danny caught a glimpse of a malign black face, almost human, and an arched tail dripping venom. And then the box flew from her hand in pieces, turning end over end. Sudden pain twisted her fingers. As she cried out and clutched a hand, the brass merchant let out a shriek, A woman screamed, and suddenly the Carthene were shouting and pushing each other aside. Ser Jorah slammed past her, and Danny stumbled to one knee. She heard the hiss again. The old man drove the butt of his staff into the ground. Aego came riding through an egg seller stall and vaulted from his saddle. Jogo's whip cracked overhead. Ser Jorah slammed the eunuch over the head with a brass platter. Sailors and whores and merchants were fleeing or shouting, or both.
"Your Grace, a thousand pardons," the old man knelt. "It's dead. Did I break your end?"
She closed her fingers, wincing. "I don't think so."
"I had to knock it away."
He started, but her blood riders were on him before he could finish. Aego kicked his staff away, and Jogo seized him around the shoulders, forced him to his knees, and pressed a dagger to his throat. "Khaleesi, we saw him strike you. Would you see the colour of his blood? Release him." Danny climbed to her feet. "Look at the bottom of his staff. Blood of my blood." Ser Jorah had been shoved off his feet by the eunuch. She ran between them as Arrak and Longsword both came flashing from their sheaths. "Put down your steel. Stop it."
"Your Grace," Mormont lowered his sword only an inch, "these men attacked you."
"They were defending me." Danny snapped her hand to shake the sting from her fingers. "It was the other one, the Carthene." When she looked around, he was gone. He was a sorrowful man. There was a manticore in that jewel box he gave me. This man knocked it out of my hand. The brass merchant was still rolling on the ground. She went to him and helped him to his feet. "Were you stung?"
"No, good lady," he said, shaking, "or else I would be dead. But it touched me. When it fell from the box, it landed on my arm."
He had soiled himself, she saw, and no wonder. She gave him a silver for his trouble and sent him on his way before she turned back to the old man with a white beard. "Who is it that I owe my life to?"
"You owe me nothing, Your Grace. I am called Arst, and though Belwas named me Whitebeard on the voyage here."
Though Jogo had released him, the old man remained on one knee. Aego picked up his staff, turned it over, cursed softly in Dothraki, scraped the remains of the manticore off on a stone and handed it back. "And who is Belwas?" she asked. The huge brown eunuch swaggered forward, sheathing his arrak.
"I am Belwas. Strong Belwas they name me, in the fighting pits of Meereen. Never did I lose."
He slapped his belly, covered with scars.
"I let each man cut me once before I kill him. Count the cuts, and you will know how many strong Belwas are slain."
Danny had no need to count his scars. There were many. She could see at a glance. "And why are you here, strong Belwas?"
"From Meereen I am sold to Cahor, and then to Pentas, and the fat man with sweet stink in his hair. He it was who sent strong Belwas back across the sea, and old white beard to serve him."
The fat man with sweet stink in his hair. "Illyrio?" she said. "You were sent by Magister Illyrio?"
"We were, Your Grace,"
old Whitebeard replied.
"The Magister begs your kind indulgence for sending us in his stead. But he cannot sit a horse as he did in his youth, and sea travel upsets his digestion."
Earlier he had spoken in the Valyrian of the Free Cities, but now he changed to the common tongue.
"I regret if we caused you alarm. If truth be told, we were not certain. We expected someone more...
Regal?" Danny laughed. She had no dragon with her, and her raiment was hardly queenly. "You speak the common tongue well," asked Tan. "Are you of Westeros?"
"I am. I was born on the Dornish marches, Your Grace. As a boy, I squired for a knight of Lord Swan's household."
He held the tall staff upright beside him, like a lance in need of a banner.
"Now I squire for Belwas."
"A bit old for such, aren't you?"
Sir Jorah had shouldered his way to her side, holding the brass platter awkwardly under his arm. Belwas's hard head had left it badly bent.
"Not too old to serve my liege, Lord Mormont. Oh, you know me as well. I saw you fight a time or two. At Lannisport, when you near unhorsed the Kingslayer, and on Pike, there as well. You do not recall Lord Mormont?"
Sir Jorah frowned.
"Your face seems familiar, but there were hundreds at Lannisport and thousands on Pike, and I am no lord. Bear Island was taken from me. I am but a knight."
"A knight of my Queen's Guard," Danny took his arm, "and my true friend and good counsellor." She studied Arston's face. He had a great dignity to him, a quiet strength she liked. "Rise, Arston Whitebeard. Be welcome, strong Belwas. Sir Jorah, you know, Co-Ego and Co-Jogo are blood of my blood. They crossed the Red Waste with me and saw my dragons born."
"Horsa boys," Belwas grinned toothily. "Belwas has killed many horsa boys in the fighting pitch. They jingle when they die."
Ego's Arrak leapt to his hand.
"Never have I killed a fat brown man. Belwas will be the first. Sheathe your still, blood of my blood," said Danny.
"This man comes to serve me. Belwas, you will accord all respect to my people, or you will leave my service sooner than you'd wish, and with more scars than when you came." The gap-toothed smile faded from the giant's broad brown face, replaced by a confused scowl. Men did not often threaten Belwas, it would seem, and less so girls a third his size. Danny gave him a smile to take a bit of the sting from the rebuke. "Now tell me, what would Magister Illyrio have of me, that he would send you all the way from Pentos?"
"He would have a dragons," said Belwas gruffly, "and the girl who makes them. He would have you."
"Belwas has the truth of us, your grace," said Arston. "We were told to find you and bring you back to Pentos. The Seven Kingdoms have need of you. Robert the Usurper is dead, and the realm bleeds. When we set sail from Pentos, there were four kings in the land, and no justice to be had."
Joy bloomed in her heart, but Danny kept it from her face. "I have three dragons," she said, "and more than 100 in my Khalasar, with all their goods and horses."
"It is no matter," boom Belwas. "We take all. The fat man hires 3 ships for his little silver-haired queen."
"It is so, your grace,"
Arston Whitebeard said.
"The great cog, Sir Dulian, is berthed at the end of the quay, and the galleys, Summer Sun, and Jozo's Prank are anchored beyond the breakwater."
3 heads has the dragon, Danny thought, wondering. "I shall tell my people to make ready to depart at once, but the ships that bring me home must bear different names."
"As you wish," said Arston. "What names would you prefer?"
"Vhagar," Daenerys told him, "Meraxes, and Balerion. Paint the names on their hulls in golden letters 3 feet high, Arston. I want every man who sees them to know the dragons are returned." Davos. Their voices rose like cinders, swirling up into purple evening sky. "Lead us from the darkness, O my lord. Fill our hearts with fire, so we may walk your shining path." The night fire burned against the gathering dark, a great bright beast whose shifting orange light threw shadows 20 feet tall across the yard. All along the walls of Dragonstone, the army of gargoyles and grotesques seemed to stir and shift. Davos looked down from an arched window in the gallery above. He watched Melisandre lift her arms as if to embrace the shivering flames. "R'hllor," she sang in a voice loud and clear, "you are the light in our eyes, the fire in our hearts, the heat in our loins. Yours is the sun that warms our days, yours the stars that guard us in the dark of night.
Lord of light, defend us. The night is dark and full of terrors.
Queen Selyse led the responses, her pinched face full of fervour. King Stannis stood beside her, jaw clenched hard, the points of his red-gold crown shimmering whenever he moved his head.
He is with them, but not of them,
Davos thought. Princess Shireen was between them, the mottled grey patches on her face and neck almost black in the firelight.
Lord of light, protect us,
the queen sang. The king did not respond with the others. He was staring into the flames. Davos wondered what he saw there.
Another vision of the war to come, or something close at home?
Relor, who gave us breath, we thank you, sang Melisande. Relor, who gave us day, we thank you. We thank you for the sun that warms us, Queen Selyse and the other worshippers replied. We thank you for the stars that watch us. We thank you for our hearths and for our torches that keep the savage dark at bay. There were fewer voices saying the responses than there had been the night before, it seemed to Davos. Fewer faces flushed with orange light about the fire. But would there be fewer still on the morrow? Or more? The voice of Sir Axel Florent rang loud as a trumpet. He stood barrel-chested and bandy-legged, the firelight washing his face like a monstrous orange tongue. Davos wondered if Sir Axel would thank him after. The work they did tonight might well make him the king's hand, as he dreamed. Melisande cried,
We thank you, Faustinus. By your grace, our king. We thank you for the pure white fire of his goodness, for the red sword of justice in his hand, for the love he bears his leal people. Guide him and defend him, Relor, and grant him strength to smite his foes.
Grant him strength, answered Queen Selyse, Sir Axel, Devon, and the rest. Grant him courage, grant him wisdom. When he was a boy, the Septons had taught Davos to pray to the crone for wisdom, to the warrior for courage, to the smith for strength. But it was the mother he prayed to now, to keep his sweet son Devon safe from the Red Woman's demon god.
Lord Davos, we'd best be about it. Sir Andrew touched his elbow gently. My lord?
The title still rang queer in his ears, yet Davos turned away from the window.
Oi, it's time.
Stannis Melisande and the Queen's men would be at their prayers an hour or more. The Red Priest lit their fires every day at sunset to thank Relor for the day just ending and beg him to send his son back on the morrow to banish the gathering darkness.
A smuggler must know the tides and when to seize them.
That was all he was at the end of the day. Davos, the smuggler. His maimed hand rose to his throat for his luck and found nothing. He snatched it down and walked a bit more quickly. His companions kept pace, matching their strides to his own. The bastard of Nightsong had a pox-ravaged face and an air of tattered chivalry. Sir Gerald Gower was broad, bluff and blonde. Sir Andrew Estamont stood a head taller, with a spade-shaped beard and shaggy brown eyebrows. They were all good men in their own ways, Davos thought.
And they will all be dead men soon, if this night's work goes badly.
Fire is a living thing,
the Red Woman told him when he asked her to teach him how to see the future in the flames.
It is always moving, always changing, like a book whose letters dance and shift even as you try to read them. It takes years of training to see the shapes beyond the flames, and more years still to learn to tell the shapes of what will be from what may be or what was. Even then, it comes hard. Hard. You do not understand that, you men of the Sunset Lands.
Davis asked her then how it was that Sir Axel had learned the trick of it so quickly. But to that she only smiled enigmatically and said,
"Any cat may stare into a fire and see red mice at play."
He had not lied to his king's men about that or any of it.
"The Red Woman may see what we intend," he warned them.
"We should start by killing her, then," urged Lewis, the fishwife. "I know a place where we could waylay her, four of us, with sharp swords."
"You doom us all," said Davis. "Maester Cressin tried to kill her, and she knew at once. From her flames, I guess. It seems to me that she is very quick to sense any threat to her own person, but surely she cannot see everything. If we ignore her, perhaps we might escape her notice."
"There is no honour in hiding and sneaking," objected Sir Tristan of Tally Hill, who had been a sunglass man before Lord Gunther went to Melisande's fires.
"Is it so honourable to burn?" Davis asked him. "You saw Lord Sunglass die. Is that what you want? I don't need men of honour now. I need smugglers. Are you with me or no?"
They were. Gods be good, they were. Maester Pylas was leading Edric Storm through his sons when Davis pushed open the door. Sir Andrew was close behind him. The others had been left to guard the steps and cellar door. The maester broke off.
"That will be enough for now, Edric."
The boy was puzzled by the intrusion.
"Lord Davis, Sir Andrew, we were doing sums."
Sir Andrew smiled. "I hated sums when I was your age, cos—"
"I don't mind them so much. I like history best, though. It's full of tales."
"Edric," said Maester Pylas, "run and get your cloak now. You're to go with Lord Davis."
"I am."
Edric got to his feet.
"Where are we going?"
His mouth set stubbornly.
"I won't go to pray to the Lord of Light. I'm a warrior's man, like my father."
"We know," Davis said. "Come, lad, we must not dawdle."
Edric donned a thick hooded cloak of undyed wool. Maester Pylas helped him fasten it and pull the hood up to shadow his face.
"Are you coming with us, maester?"
the boy asked.
"No."
Pylas touched the chain of many metals he wore about his neck.
"My place is here on Dragonstone.
Go with Lord Davis now, and do as he says. He is the king's hand, remember? What did I tell you about the king's hand?"
"The hand speaks with the king's voice."
The young maester smiled. "That's so. Go now." Davis had been uncertain of Pylas. Perhaps he resented him for taking old Crescent's place. But now he could only admire the man's courage.
"This could mean his life as well."
Outside the maester's chambers, Sir Gerald Gower waited by the steps. Edric Storm looked at him curiously. As they made their descent, he asked,
"Where are we going, Lord Davis?"
"To the water. A ship awaits you."
The boy stopped suddenly.
"A ship?"
"One of Salador Sands. Sala is a good friend of mine."
"I shall go with you, cousin," Sir Andrew assured him. "There's nothing to be frightened of." "I am not frightened," Edric said indignantly. "Only, is Shireen coming too?"
"No," said Davis. "The princess must remain here with her father and mother."
"I have to see her then," Edric explained, "to say my farewells, otherwise she'll be sad."
"Not so sad as if she sees you burn." "There is no time," Davis said. "I will tell the princess that you were thinking of her, and you can write her when you get to where you're going."
The boy frowned.
"Are you sure I must go? Why would my uncle send me from Dragonstone? Did I displease him? I never meant to."
He got that stubborn look again.
"I want to see my uncle. I want to see King Stannis."
Sir Andrew and Sir Gerald exchanged a look.
"There's no time for that, cousin," Sir Andrew said.
"I want to see him,"
Edric insisted louder.
"He does not want to see you."
Davis had to say something to get the boy moving.
"I am his hand. I speak with his voice. Must I go to the king and tell him that you would not do as you were told? Do you know how angry that will make him? Have you ever seen your uncle angry?"
He pulled off his glove and showed the boy the four fingers that Stannis had shortened.
"I have."
It was all lies. There had been no anger in Stannis Baratheon when he cut the ends off his Onion Knight's fingers, only an iron sense of justice. But Edric Storm had not been born then, and could not know that, and the threat had the desired effect.
"He should not have done that," the boy said, but he let Davos take him by the hand and draw him down the steps.
The bastard of Nightsong joined them at the cellar door. They walked quickly across a shadowed yard and down some steps under the stone tail of a frozen dragon. Lewis the Fishwife and Omer Blackberry waited at the postern gate, two guards bound and trussed at their feet.
"The boat," Davos asked them.
"It's there," Lewis said. "Four oarsmen. The galley is anchored just past the point. Mad Prendis."
Davos chuckled.
"A ship named after a madman. Yes, that's fitting."
Cellar had a streak of the pirate's black humor. He went to one knee before Edric Storm.
"I must leave you now," he said. "There's a boat waiting to row you out to a galley. Then it's off across the sea. You are Robert's son, so I know you will be brave, no matter what happens."
"I will, only..."
The boy hesitated.
"Think of this as an adventure, my lord."
Davos tried to sound hale and cheerful.
"It's a start of your life's great adventure. May the warrior defend you."
"And may the father judge you justly, Lord Davos."
The boy went with his cousin, Sir Andrew, out the postern gate. The others followed, all but the bastard of Nightsong.
"May the father judge me justly,"
Davos thought ruefully. But it was the king's judgment that concerned him now.
"These two?"
asked Sir Roland of the guards when he had closed and barred the gate.
"Drag them into a cellar," said Davos. "You can cut them free when Edric's safely underway."
The bastard gave a curt nod. There were no more words to say. The easy part was done. Davos pulled his glove on, wishing he had not lost his luck. He had been a better man and a braver one with that bag of bones around his neck. He ran his shortened fingers through thinning brown hair and wondered if it needed to be cut. He must look presentable when he stood before the king. Dragonstone had never seemed so dark and fearsome. He walked slowly, his footsteps echoing off black walls and dragons.
"Stone dragons who will never wake, I pray."
The stone drum loomed huge ahead of him. The guards at the door uncrossed their spears as he approached.
"Not for the Onion Knight, but for the king's hand."
Davos was the hand going in, at least. He wondered what he would be coming out.
"If I ever do."
The steps seemed longer and steeper than before, or perhaps it was just that he was tired.
"The mother never made me for tasks like this."
He had risen too high and too fast, and up here on the mountain the air was too thin for him to breathe. As a boy he had dreamed of riches, but that was long ago. Later, grown, all he had wanted was a few acres of good land, a hall to grow old in, a better life for his sons. The blind bastard used to tell him that a clever smuggler did not overreach, nor draw too much attention to himself.
"A few acres, a timbered roof, a sir before my name. I should have been content."
If he survived this night, he would take Devon and sail home to Cape Wrath and his gentle Maria.
"We will grieve together for our dead sons, raise the living ones to be good men, and speak no more of kings."
The chamber of the painted table was dark and empty when Davos entered. The king would still be at the night fire with Melisandre and the Queen's men. He knelt and made a fire in the hearth to drive the chill from the round chamber and chase the shadows back into their corners. Then he went around the room to each window in turn, opening the heavy velvet curtains and unlatching the wooden shutters. The wind came in, strong with the smell of salt and sea, and pulled at his plain brown cloak. At the north window, he leaned against the sill for a breath of the cold night air, hoping to catch a glimpse of Mad Prendus raising sail. But the sea seemed black and empty as far as the eye could see.
"She gone already?"
He could only pray that she was, and the boy with her. A half-moon was sliding in and out amongst high, thin clouds, and Davis could see familiar stars. There was the galley, sailing west. There the crone's lantern, four bright stars that enclosed a golden haze. The clouds hid most of the ice dragon, all but the bright blue eye that marked due north.
"The sky is full of smugglers' stars."
They were old friends, those stars. Davis hoped that meant good luck. But when he lowered his gaze from the sky to the castle ramparts, he was not so certain. The wings of the stone dragons cast great black shadows in the light from the night fire. He tried to tell himself that they were no more than carvings, cold and lifeless.
"This was their place once, a place of dragons and dragon lords, the seat of House Tregarion."
The Tregarions were the blood of old Valyria. The wind sighed through the chamber, and in the hearth the flames gusted and swirled. He listened to the logs crackle and spit. When Davis left the window, his shadow went before him, tall and thin, and fell across the painted table like a sword. And there he stood for a long time, waiting. He heard their boots on the stone steps as they ascended. The king's voice went before him.
"It's not three," he was saying.
"Three is three," came Melisandre's answer. "I swear to you, Your Grace, I saw him die and heard his mother's wail."
"In the night fire?" Stannis and Melisandre came through the door together. "The flames are full of tricks. What is, what will be, what may be. You cannot tell me for a certainty."
"Your Grace,"
Davos stepped forward,
"Lady Melisandre saw it true. Your nephew, Joffrey, is dead."
If the king was surprised to find him at the painted table, he gave no sign. "Lord Davos," he said, "he was not my nephew, though for years I believed he was."
"He choked on a morsel of food at his wedding feast," Davos said. "It may be that he was poisoned."
"He is the third," said Melisandre.
"I can count, woman." Stannis walked along the table, past Old Town and the Arbor, up toward the Shield Islands and the mouth of the Mander. "Weddings have become more perilous than battles, it would seem. Who was the poisoner? Is it known?"
"His uncle, it said, the imp."
Stannis ground his teeth. "A dangerous man. I learned that on the Blackwater. How'd you come by this report?"
"The Iseni still trade at King's Landing. Salador San has no reason to lie to me."
"I suppose not." The king ran his fingers across the table.
"Joffrey. I remember once. This kitchen cat. The cooks were wont to feed her scraps and fish heads. One told the boy that she had kittens in her belly, thinking he might want one. Joffrey opened up the poor thing with a dagger to see if it were true. When he found the kittens, he brought them to show to his father. Robert hit the boy so hard, I thought he'd killed him."
The king took off his crown and placed it on the table. "Dwarf or leech, this killer served the kingdom well. They must send for me now."
"They will not," said Melisandre. "Joffrey has a brother."
"Tommen," the king said the name grudgingly.
"They will crown Tommen and rule
in his name. Stannis made a fist. Tommen is gentler than Joffrey, but born of the same incest. Another monster in the making, another leech upon the land. Westeros needs a man's hand, not a child's. Melisandre moved closer. Save them, sire. Let me wake the stone dragons. Three is three. Give me the boy. Edric Storm, Davos said. Stannis rounded on him in cold fury. I know his name. Spare me your reproaches. I like this no more than you do, but my duty is to the realm. My duty. He turned back to Melisandre. You swear there is no other way? Swear it on your life, for I promise you shall die by inches if you lie. You are he who must stand against the other, the one whose coming was prophesied 5,000 years ago. The red comet was your herald. You are the prince that was promised, and if you fail, the world fails with you. Melisandre went to him, her red lips parted, her ruby throbbing. Give me this boy, she whispered, and I will give you your kingdom.
He can't, said Davos. Edric Storm is gone.
Gone? Stannis turned. What do you mean, gone?
He is aboard the Lyseni galley, safely out to sea.
Davos watched Melisandre's pale, heart-shaped face. He saw the flicker of dismay there, the sudden uncertainty.
She did not see it.
The king's eyes were dark blue bruises in the hollows of his face. The bastard was taken from Dragonstone without my leave. A galley, you say? If that Lyseni pirate thinks to use the boy to squeeze gold from me. This is your hand's work, sire. Melisandre gave Davos a knowing look.
You will bring him back, my lord. You will. The boy is out of my reach, said Davos. And out of your reach as well, my lady.
Her red eyes made him squirm.
I should have left you to the dark, sir. Do you know what you have done?
My duty.
Some might call it treason. Stannis went to the window to stare out into the night.
Is he looking for the ship?
I raised you up from dirt, Davos. He sounded more tired than angry. Was loyalty too much to hope for?
Four of my sons died for you on the Blackwater. I might have died myself. You have my loyalty, always.
Davos Seaworth had thought long and hard about the words he said next. He knew his life depended on them.
Your Grace, you made me swear to give you honest counsel and swift obedience, to defend your realm against your foes, to protect your people. Is not Edric Storm one of your people? One of those I swore to protect. I kept my oath. How could that be treason?
Stannis ground his teeth again. I never ask for this crown. Gold is cold and heavy on the head, but so long as I am the king, I have a duty. If I must sacrifice one child to the flames, to save a million from the dark.
Sacrifice is never easy, Davos. Or it is no true sacrifice. Tell him, my lady.
Melisandre said,
Azor Ahai, tempered Lightbringer, with the heart's blood of his own beloved wife. If a man with 1,000 cows gives one to God, that is nothing. But a man who offers the only cow he owns.
She talks of cows, Davos told the king. I am speaking of a boy, your daughter's friend, your brother's son.
A king's son, with the power of king's blood in his veins.
Melisandre's ruby glowed like a red star at her throat.
Do you think you've saved this boy, Onion Knight? When the long night falls, Edric Storm shall die with the rest, wherever he is hidden. Your own sons as well. Darkness and cold will cover the earth. You meddle in matters you do not understand.
"There's much I don't understand," Davis admitted. "I have never pretended elsewise.